One of the things we like best about producing the show each week is the chance to sit down with incredibly gifted storytellers and artists, to hear them describe their craft, and to benefit from their unique perspective on the world. Today we have a guest who is all of those things and more. She's Sarah Giordino, this week on Story in the Public Square. Hello and welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Alongside me is my friend and co-host, G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. Each week, we talk about big issues with great guests, authors, journalists, filmmakers, and more, to make sense of the stories that shape public life in the United States today. To help us this week, we're joined by Sarah Giordino, who is an award-winning filmmaker, visual artist, and researcher, as well as being an assistant professor at the Rhode Island School of Design. Sarah, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
So we like to spend a little time getting to know our guests before we sort of talk about the specifics of your work. And your background is interesting. So tell us a little bit about where you're from and how you got into filmmaking.
Well, I'm from a little factory town in northern Sweden, around 6,000 people in the town. So it's not really a town, I guess.
It's a small
community.
Town. Yeah.
It's a small community.
And it's when you say northern, this is really northern.
Yes, this is 5 hours drive to the Arctic Circle. So it is,
it's
Northern Lights. Everyone, I know Northern Lights. I grew up watching Northern Lights all the time in the winters. Yeah. So I'm from a small place. And
when did you come to the States?
I came in 2000. I had moved then in Sweden. I was in grad school for visual art. And I got the opportunity to come to the United States, to UCLA, to study with a professor there, Mary Kelly. And so I came in September of 2000. And it was so crazy because that everyone was like, who's the president? I think that I'd never been in the United States, and then coming at that moment in time, 2000 and then 2001, was a very interesting experience.
Very
transformative.
Yeah.
Transformative.
And so were you already a filmmaker in Sweden before you came to the United States?
I was an artist who worked with moving images.
Okay.
And it was around the time also where we saw more and more museums exhibit artists that dealt with documentary subjects and research-based art. So we worked as documentarians, but we wouldn't necessarily show our films in theaters or broadcast. It would be in a video installation or in a gallery space.
Interesting.
But we were dealing with, a lot of using documentary methods, documentary film methods.
So what were the subjects of some of your earlier documentaries? And then we're going to very soon get into some of your current work. But early work, what interested you? What did you want to capture on?
The early work. I think the first early work, you really do things about your family. I see this with my students. You tend to do things about, your family, the place you grew up maybe. And I did some of that and returned to that later also. But I did a long, long piece about, seven works in that archive about Ingmar Bergman, which includes, photographs, videos, a 16mm film, and it was about Ingmar Bergman's film Persona.
Did you watch a lot of his films growing up? Of course, he's the great filmmaker.
Yes, he's like the father of culture. But he's the father of culture. There was always, this notion that the next Bergman is always a male.
Right.
So there definitely is this Yeah, he has an impact on the cultural life in Sweden.
You said that, you know, you saw this in your current students and even in your earlier work, this focus on family. Is that sort of a is that the result of telling stories about things that you know? Is it because the material's right there for you, right?
Yes, I think you go to that, your own experience, and at the same time you don't know it because you're living it, so you have no distance to it. Which is why I won't tell you too many details about my earlier work. But I returned later to make film about the community where I grew up, actually. And then I came as a grown-up, and I had some distance, and I could put it in a context, a global context. And that was a piece I did.
So yeah. A lot of your work explores groups and communities facing different types of marginalization. That's how you describe it on your website. What are we talking about, or who are we? What communities are we talking about, and when did that interest begin to intersect with your early work in terms of filmmaking? In other words, where did your passion for this subject come from, and how did it develop?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. We go back to home. I mean, if you live in a small rural community, very, very far from, you know, Stockholm and another, you know, centers and cultural centers, economical centers, then you are in the periphery. So I was early on interested in periphery and the stories of people that were not necessarily told, like the untold stories of people that I felt were equally important, the unknowns, the people that maybe didn't grow up in the cultural elite in Stockholm, for example, that was so easy to get a voice there, the people, the voiceless. When that interest came, I mean, I think that, you know, I am in some ways a minority myself. I'm, you know, I'm a woman, I'm a gay woman, I'm LGBTQ, and we form communities, what we call chosen communities. And I think also as a feminist, as a woman, we also form, you know, the women's movement. And I was really involved in all of that. And that becomes like an extended family. And I'm very interested in that dynamic.
So one of your very impressive works is a feature documentary called Kiki.
Yeah.
It won all kinds of festival awards. It was praised by the New York Times, Vanity Fair, and pretty much everywhere. And we're going to show a clip from it in a little bit, but give us a synopsis of what the film is about if members of our audience have not seen it.
Yeah, Kiki is about a social movement for LGBTQ youth of color in New York City. And it's a chosen family. Many of the kids have been kicked out of their homes and have become homeless because they're LGBTQ. But there's also a creative community. They have an art form called ballroom, and they have competitions where they compete in their art. The most well-known is voguing. So
voguing, this is the, I think of the Madonna song and the dance
yes.
style that was associated with it. That's what we're talking about.
Yes, it's that kind of voguing. But it has an enormously rich history, and it's they're you know, a very important part of the cultural fabric of New York, like as performance art. So there should really be written a whole art history about them. They are getting more and more recognition. But yeah, this is the youth, though. That could be as young. This is. You can enter these scenes. There's several scenes, complicated, but this is about a particular scene that caters to youth, LGBTQ youth. Mm-hmm. So the kids could be as young as, you know, 12, and then, you know, going to 20, 21, 22. And then they become parents, they become families. The little older kids, like the 18-year-olds, become the mother or father of the 15-year-old.
So you described your sort of interest in the stories of the marginalized. How did you find this story, though?
Yes. Well, this is the beautiful, beautiful thing about this project, is that I met this amazing, very important gatekeeper of the community, Twiggy Puccigarson and others. Yeah, Twiggy. And I met.
How did you meet him? You were in New York.
Well, we met in Harlem. I was working on another project, and we met in Harlem. And then, you know, it was Twiggy feels it's fate. It was we really, really connected on a very deep level.
Right, from the start.
Yes, from the start, and. People have asked questions about that. Twiggy is a young, you know, African-American LGBTQ person from the South. And I'm from, you know, Northern Sweden. I'm, you know, older than him. I'm this, you know, white academic. I was working as a teacher already then and filmmaker. So what could we have in common? Well, we have a lot in common, it turned out, and an amazing dialogue. And I was asked to do the project by Twiggy.
I was invited.
It's an honor. I was terrified.
Why?
It's like, because it's such a responsibility. Because I just fell in love with the community the moment I met them, and then I got this question.
When you describe it as a social movement or as a scene, they call them scenes, right? It's the Kiki scene? Am I doing that right?
Kiki is vernacular for having fun, like you're having a kiki, you're having fun.
Yeah.
And it's for the younger, the culture, the subculture, it's really a subculture, it's called house and ballroom. And this younger scene is called kiki. Mm-hmm. So it's more of an activist scene. It's more caring, it caters to the youth and what they're going through. As they're coming into themselves.
How wide is it concentrated mostly in New York? How widespread is it?
It's international.
Really?
Yeah. But it's, you know, of course, very strong in New York. And they're literally saving each other's lives within this. It's the most effective activism advocacy I've ever met is in the Kiki scene.
So let's watch a clip from Kiki.
I feel like society is starting to look at us all the same, and it's not fair. I've been arrested probably 3 times my whole life. They treated us like garbage, like just straight garbage. And it was embarrassing, it was hurtful, and I never thought I would feel like that, because I've always been the type of person to not care. But I actually really felt hurt after a while, because they was really treating us like, oh, because you're in the ballroom scene. I know y'all do this. I know y'all do that. We've arrested so many people from this type of house or that, da, 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 da. Like, it was just like, they was treating us like we're all the same person. And people fail to realize, regardless if we all label under gay, label under lesbian, label under transgender, whatever, we're all individuals.
I want to get back to Twiggy and you meeting him. There was an element of trust from both of your parts. You had to trust him that he would let you into his world. He had to trust you that you would do justice to the, how did that work? I mean, you said you connected from the start.
Yeah.
It took several years to make this film. So, I mean, trust is such an important part of documentary filmmaking, as you well know. How did that work?
It took four and a half, five years. I think we had something actually. We both came from very religious families.
Really?
And that was something, because not all LGBTQ folks, you know, get together, you know, we don't all connect with each other. But I do think that it actually was this experience from growing up in a very religious environment that we connected around. And then also Twiggy's interest. Twiggy is very much, people see this, you know, ballroom or the Kiki scene, and they see the very, very creative and impressive voguing performances and other performances. And you can see it reflect in popular culture, Madonna, Beyonce, you know, in fashion and so on. And that's wonderful in itself, but the kind of backbone of the Kiki scene is its advocacy and its being its activism, being alternative family structure that kind of lifts these youth up that are coming from, like, are struggling a lot. There's a lot of adversity.
We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. An audio version of this show can be heard four times every weekend on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's popular Politics of the United States. That's the POTUS channel, number 124. We produce Story in the Public Square with a great crew at Rhode Island PBS, and we're lucky to work with them. I'm Jim Lutis. On most days, you can find me running the Pell Center at Salve Regina University in beautiful Newport, Rhode Island. If you want to connect with me on Twitter, you can do so at JM Lutis. Joining me, as he does every week in the co-host chair, is my friend G. Wayne Miller, who is an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal and the author of 17 books, including the recently published Kid Number One. You can find Wayne on Twitter, too, at G. Wayne Miller. And our guest this week is Sarah Giardino, a filmmaker, visual artist, and researcher who's also an assistant professor at the Rhode Island School of Design. Sarah is on Twitter, too, at Sarah, J-O-R-D-E-N-O.
So obviously the artistic quality of the film was one of the reasons it won so many awards, but there's a social justice message here too, in terms of acceptance and understanding. Talk about this film in terms of furthering those goals and documentary films in general, how they can lead us to better understand us, meaning the larger world, to better understanding and appreciation and acceptance of people who are marginalized or have been marginalized. Long question, maybe you could...
No, it's a very good question, because I think also this group in particular, there's a lot of prejudice. There's a lot of ideas about who they are. And as inner city youth of color, some homeless, some struggling with, or what we call, like, you know, housing instability, mm-hmm. like homeless. Mm. Not a stable place to live. And I felt that it was so important that we could see a nuanced image about who they are, because I was so impressed with them. I was so impressed. And they're a community that talks. It's like, because I think it's therapeutic, it's cathartic. They found each other. They've been alone.
They talk to each other.
That's
what you're talking, when they say they talk, that's...
Yeah, but they also have a governance. So there's leadership and mentorship, and they're lifting each other up, and people are going through things like, you know, transitioning from, you know, their assigned gender at birth to, as male, maybe, to becoming, you know, a trans woman, and this is very dramatic. Things are happening. People are struggling. In school, getting employment, you know, financial issues, you know, racism, the police, they struggle a lot. And then the community come together and they're talking about this. They have meetings, governance meetings. The Kiki Parents and Leaders Council, you know, they have governance where they talk about how to lift each other up. If someone's getting... I remember one member of the Kiki scene as we were filming were beaten up really badly, assaulted, and because they look different, so it's actually dangerous to be out walking on the street. Immediately all the house parents, you know, they have, in the Kiki scene, there's like different teams, they're also called houses, and they all went in and like talked to the police, straightened out the situation, made sure that, you know, this member of the community was, you know, healing, all talking it out. So that's amazing for a documentary filmmaker to be able to capture.
Absolutely.
They talk about how, you know, to get more power, and they have.
So storytelling, them telling stories to each other and then through your film and other means to the larger, storytelling is integral to this society and this group.
Yeah.
Is that not true?
Absolutely.
What, you know, I'm curious though, so there's, you think about the violence perpetrated against trans women in
yes.
particular, it's a huge epidemic.
Yeah.
How responsive are authorities to violence targeting members of the LGBTQ+ community?
Well, there's harassment from the police.
Still, in 2020.
I mean, this, it's, It's a complicated issue that we can talk for a long time about, but there's definitely, we see deep racism there and prejudice against when there's violence against trans women and this notion of blaming the victim and all these kinds of things. And but even such a simple thing, I think that Kiki is trying to become very close and kind of put you in their shoes. Like, what were you, if you were walking in their shoes? Mm-hmm. We were filming in Harlem, and there were three members of the Kiki scene there, and I was the cinematographer, and I was standing kind of hidden. We were up a couple of stairs. We wanted an overview, and in a second, the police came there. Something must be going on. There's three youth of color standing in a corner. Something must be happening, and they're like, "Oh, here they go again." Mm. And that, you know, they're constantly being stopped and frisked, and you know, and to have that kind of suspicion all the time, it's so tiring. Mm.
Well, having a film that illuminates that is so important. I want to get to another one of your films, The Civil Society,
yes,
which takes us from the United States to your native land. Tell us briefly about that. It's a great issue, and it's an ongoing project too, if I understand correctly.
It is an ongoing project. It's a collaboration with my partner, Amber Horning Roof, who's a criminologist, sociologist. And we lived in Sweden for a short time when we had our son. And it was around the time when the refugee crisis, the so-called refugee crisis, happened. So a lot of refugees came from Afghanistan, from Syria, to Sweden. And what happened in Sweden, and Sweden is known to be kind of a human rights superpower. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the image that Sweden likes to project of themselves.
And it's the image that a lot of people have, I would add, in the United States for
yeah.
sure.
Yeah. But in November 2015, Sweden effectively closed its borders, made it very, very difficult to get asylum, and then went on to start to deport these youths. They came as children, but as soon as they turned 18 or their age was changed, you know, arbitrarily, "I think you look older than you are, we're going to change that," so on. Sweden started these mass deportations.
And they were sent back to war zones.
Yes, Afghanistan, one of the most dangerous countries in the world. And they had established, families mm-hmm. in Sweden. A lot of Swedish families took them in, so wanted to keep them. And the film that we made is about this group of people that met during the first big mass demonstration to Afghanistan. They didn't know each other before. They met there, and they were so shocked that this could happen in Sweden. They were so shocked by the cruelty, and that, you know, the kids were bussed away, you know, some of them drugged. And so they connected through that protest, through their experience. This was a trauma for them as well, to see that deportation being how that went about. And so then they started meeting all the time, and some of them have never been activists before, but now they build a network with like thousands of Swedish people that are helping asylum seekers, and trying to stop and protest these demonstrations.
I mean, there's such a strong parallel with what's happening in the U.S.
I'm wondering, though,
yes.
in that vein, if you can, briefly just to sort of describe what happened. Was it just merely the influx of refugees that triggered a political response? What changed in Sweden
yeah.
where this became policy?
That's actually a complicated issue, because what we see is that Sweden in November of 2015 announced, we need a breathing room, so we're going to change our policies, and we're not going to give out, we're not going to give asylum, we're not going to let people stay as much as we have before. They mm-hmm. changed, they restricted it, in many complicated ways. And you might assume then that, oh, they did that for a reason, right? Maybe they were overwhelmed, there were too many, they had to. But the truth is they didn't really have to. And part of that these policies came about is that there's the Nationalist Party is on the rise in Sweden, and it's gotten a lot of support the last couple of years. And this party is extremely hostile against the asylum seeker population, the refugee population, or anyone that isn't ethnically Swedish.
Sort of Sweden for Swedish, right? Yeah.
Yes, they have a background in neo-Nazism from the 90s, but they've been able to clean up their act and mm-hmm. legitimize their politics.
You've said that all of your work is, and I'm quoting here, inherently political. Can you unpack that for us?
Yes. Well, in a way that is not such a smart statement, really, because because truly, you know, you can't escape being political. If you say that you're making film just for entertainment or happiness, that's also a political stance. Mm-hmm. Then you're, you know. But I think for me, I'm trying to talk about my devotion to social justice, and that I am very interested in how social movements form and how people can, you know, move into activism, how that can become a really important part of their person, how their life can change. Like with these people that met by the demonstration, in Sweden, that deportation demonstration, they talk about a before and after. So they're like, it was life before we saw this suffering, and it was life after. And life after, I have to do everything in my power to stop this human rights violation, is what they saw.
So we have just a few seconds.
Okay.
Very, very briefly, what are you working on now? And we happen to know it's a film about your daughter. And again, we only have a few seconds.
Okay.
Unfortunately.
Like 10. I'm working on a film about my daughter. My daughter, I didn't carry my daughter, my partner did. So she's 3 now, and I'm in the process of adopting her. And the film is both a personal reflection on that process of having to adopt your own daughter, but also involves, you know, the activism, parentage activism that's going on in the United States.
We will look forward to seeing it.
Thank you.
Sarah Giardino, thank you so much for being with us. That is all the time we have this week, but if you want to know more about Story in the Public Square, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter or visit pellcenter.org. He's Wayne, I'm Jim, asking you to join us again next time for more Story in the Public Square.